Hey, and welcome back to another exciting episode of Extra Features Podcast. Today we have two people in the house, which is always good. We have Richard Lett here. Oh, God, we have Richard Lett, who's never be done, the story of his life. And we also have the director, Roy Teague.
Roy Ty.
Ty, I'm close. We're both here. Welcome to the show, guys. We're going to have some fun tonight. We're going to mix up some questions. Feel free to jump in on either one's questions if you guys want. I'm not worried about it. So let's start with you at the beginning, Roy. Why Richard?
It wasn't really like a conscious decision of me like going, oh, I'm looking to make a documentary. And I did a bunch of research on who I wanted to make a documentary on. It's not the case at all. Richard actually originally hit me up. Our friend Danny Mendelo, who's a producer on the show, on this documentary, he introduced us, and Richard hit me up looking for someone to do a tape. He wanted to do a one-man show, and he wanted it recorded. So he reached out to me, seeing if I would be interested. So we met up, and we happened to live in the same neighborhood. We were neighbors, and we met up at the Starbucks, and just started talking and hit it off. And for me, it seemed like, oh, this seems like he's a cool guy. I get along with him. Different than what I was used to meeting with people, because I would get a lot of people wanting to work with me at that time. A very, very traditional way of working in Canada is to try and get artists to work for free. So you get hit up a lot when you have a camera. So I was young at the time and just looking to get involved in different things. So, we would just talk that day, and I was like, all right, that sounds cool. And the idea was to shoot BTS kind of style for the one man show. And I was like, all right, that's kind of a cool idea. So I was like, well, let's just start filming now. And so I went and started filming. And then that night we went out to film him do a set and work on his material. We got kicked out of the club, and that's the beginning of the documentary. So at first it was just me hanging out, wanting to do it, and then it just unfolded into what it unfolded into.
So, Richard, next question for you. Do you like the story of your life being on film? Like, this is pretty heavy stuff.
Yes. Well, you know, it is the story of a part of my life, and certainly, you know, anyone who is an addict, you know, it can easily be the end of their lives. And so, you know, part of the process of getting into recovery is finding out what good you are and what you're good for. And so do I enjoy the documentary? No. I think, you know, it's a quality documentary. I'm a big fan of documentaries, and so I watch quite a few of them. And so I think it's very good. It's strange, excuse me, to have a documentary about yourself while you're still alive and while you're relatively unknown. You know, it's sort of a challenge to see this and to be okay with it. But on the other hand, the sort of recovery that I'm in from alcoholism and drug addiction is, as they say, abstinent-based, and part of a 12-step program. And the 12 steps make it fairly clear that our payment for recovery is to tell our story and to try and help other people who struggle with it. And so I think the film goes a long way to do that, and not just from, you know, little, you know, gatherings here and there, but in a worldwide kind of way. So the short answer to that is I'm proud of this film.
Okay. That was back to Roy. Would you consider Richard a shock comic?
No. I have a different view on comedy because I did it. I that's how I originally met Richard was when I was 18. I first did stand up comedy, and so I've been involved in the arts myself since I was, you know, a boy. So my look on comedy, I always find it funny when people are like, oh, that's a shock comedian, or that's a dirty comedian, or, oh, he's a clean comic. It's like, no, it's just an art form, and that's the way that they express themselves. So I don't think that Richard is deliberately going out there being like, I'm going to shock the audience tonight. Like, I think it was just like an expression of who he was at that time. And when I watch his comedy today, it's just a different expression, but it's still the same man behind it, right? And artists evolve and people evolve. So no, I don't think he's like a shock comic, and I never viewed it as that. To be honest with you, I'm a fan of his comedy. I always was. That's why I was originally introduced to him. Is that like I was writing a web series at the time and shooting it, and I wanted Richard to play a character in it because when I was 18, I did stand up at an open mic, and Richard just happened to be the headliner that night. And if you do stand up in Vancouver at that time, there's no way you could not walk into any place doing comedy and not run into Richard. I didn't know him, but my first time ever doing stand-up, I came off stage and he was in the back laughing, and he said, good set, kid. And for me, I felt good because I knew him as a comic already and I liked his material. And for him to give me validation, I was like, oh, cool, like, that's fucking awesome. You know what I mean? But then I never formed a relationship with him until about, you know, 8 years later when we started doing the documentary and I started, you know, following his life. So, yeah, I was just always been a fan of him, and now I just consider him a brother.
Okay, Richard, I watch a lot of comedy. I've watched your comedy sets. I watched early Richard. I've watched late Richard. I've watched you ridicule hecklers on a magnificent level. Would you not consider your comedy shock comedy at times? I mean, you do go a little bit overboard at times. I love it. Do not get me wrong. I'm not faulting it. I'm just saying you tend to reach a bit and try to antagonize the audience.
Well, you know, guilty as charged, but, I do slam poetry. I play music. With Roy's point that there's, you know, more to me than just that, but certainly enjoy provoking people. And arguably there's a point in time where I was mentally ill, and you know, there's kind of the late great Mike McDonald would describe comedians as diagnosed or undiagnosed. My diagnosis, I wasn't necessarily diagnosed then, but I certainly am now. And so, I sought out. I was full of rage. I was, treated badly as a kid, and I had blackout rage issues and all sorts of things like that. And so I would seek out, people to, antagonize. And I also had a terrible sense of entitlement, and that I show to me when I'm just trying to do a show or throw me off in any kind of way, then yeah, I would go straight at them. And one friend described my attack on a heckler, by the response from the heckler was he didn't know what to say and he wasn't going to try. And, you know, that is sort of the, you know, I just wanted to send out the message that there was very little future in heckling me. On the other hand, sometimes on those shows out there on the road and, you know, where you're dealing with a rowdy crowd, it really became a brawl. And the way that I succeeded was to bring them on and take them down. And people loved that part of the show. And so, whether I was in a comedy club where it was more a controlled environment or out there, you know, playing those bars, I think the final analysis, I was looking to entertain people and make them laugh. And so that was really the goal. Did I say shocking things? Absolutely. I'm also kind of a politico. I have strong opinions about things. And so, you know, the notorious ballad of Bobby Pickton, which, of course, Freud did a great job of making worse by deliberately so to show the intense nature of that particular piece, was born not out of a dismissal of these people's lives that had been lost to the serial killer, but a condemnation of a culture and a society that romanticizes serial killers and you know, sort of eulogizes these people, and it's really completely, you know, just not accountable for a society that puts people in a vulnerable place, and then when they are unceremoniously dismissed, putting their pictures, the worst pictures possible, unless they're a pretty girl, then a very pretty picture of them in the paper, right? And so that's what that thing was a response to the media and our own culture and our own government and our own policing that allowed those, you know, somewhere between 30 and 50 Native addicted prostitutes to be killed in Vancouver during that time period. So I actually cared about that shit, but it didn't really come off that way. And that's the other thing, just to put a pin on this or to stick the landing on this, is that I was addicted to cocaine and alcohol during that time period, and there's an enormous amount of entitlement that comes with that sort of consumption. And so not only did I, you know, have this righteous indignation, but I didn't care who I hurt when I said it. And there, that they say that brutality is honesty without compassion. And so the song, The Ballad of Bobby Pickton, was lacking the degree of compassion that it would need, and particularly in that version of it that Roy was able to put in the film, was brutal. And I don't enjoy watching that. And when I've seen the film, I've often had to just, you know, close my eyes or turn away during that part because I know the harm it did.
Wow, that's a fabulous answer. I don't know how to come back from that, but I do. When you're doing Roy, when you're doing interviews with other comedians, how does that feel? Is everybody willing to talk to you?
Yeah, for the most part. A couple people, to be honest with you, I had to lie to a couple people. I was at first saying that I was doing a documentary on, well, it depended. Some people were like, cool. They're like, oh, Richard, I love Richard. Yeah, yeah. Like, it was really that situation where a lot of people were like really good fans of him, like Jeff Lauren, who is a comedian himself, but also like a promoter. He's always been a fan of Richard. So he was like, yeah, I'll do one. Sure. Whatever works best for you. And then there was people that were like, no, I don't want anything to do with that. So some people I kind of already knew. So I would lie and say, oh, I'm doing a documentary on comedians in Vancouver, in the comedy scene. And Richard is just someone I'm kind of following to get to know everyone. They'd be like, oh, okay. Yeah, I could do an interview on that. And it was so funny because they would just like, comedians are a funny breed, and I don't know what it is, but they just love talking about themselves. So it was a great way to get the interview initially, and then I would go in and I would ask a lot about their career, and they would just love talking about it. And then I would just then filter in the odd question about Richard to get those answers that I was looking for. So like that's how I kind of had to approach it quite a few times. And then there was some people that were unhappy with him that just wanted to say what they wanted to say on camera and didn't give a fuck that the documentary was about Richard. And then there was the odd person who just didn't want anything to do with it, and they turned me down on some interviews. So, yeah, I got the best I could with the people that I could and that were around. There's, you know, always some interviews that you wish you could have grabbed, but then I got some that I didn't think I was going to get. So And then ones that I thought that I needed, they got left on the cutting room floor too. So, you know, you just, when you're making a doc, it's like war, you know, you just get what you can get and live with the results, you know?
Okay, Richard, it's kind of touched on the film, but I didn't get answered. Why are you banned from the Yuck Yucks in Kingston?
Oh, no, not in Kingston. The Kingston was a pub. So he got in trouble. So yeah. So he got in trouble with Yuck Yucks and was like kicked off the Yuck Yucks tour briefly or for a while. Richard, I think, would have a better answer than that. And at that time, he just got booted from the Kingston, which is what we filmed him getting booted from. When that guy's kicking him, he got kicked out of there that night and was no longer allowed to go to the Kingston. So they're two separate places.
Oh, I'm
Kingston
sorry.
Was like, what? Yeah. No, I get what you're saying because your research, right? Kingston, Ontario. So hats off to you for figuring that out. But no, it's two separate places. But Richard, you can express more on those two bannings.
Well, I think the initial thing that when Roy and I, the beginning of the movie, me getting kicked out of the Yuck Yucks, there was a manager that had only been around a short period of time, and I had been around a long time, so he came in, and I think he was really trying to assert his authority, and didn't really care for people asserting their authority, especially when I didn't think they had any. And as it turned out, and I think it's fairly well explained in the documentary, he was wearing a pink shirt, and I made fun of that by going up to one of the staff members, whom I'd known for a while. Like, staff had been around longer than this guy had. I can't really remember his name. It probably wouldn't be useful for me to say it anyway. But I said, do you all have to wear pink shirts? And that annoyed him. And because, you know, he was, you know, trying to be a big shot. I also believe because he was small and bald, I believe I gave him the nickname Mussolini. And one of the ways you see it with, you know, Trump and how to diminish people or dismiss people by giving them nicknames. And that was a habit that I was in as well. So by calling him, but my nicknames were a little more clever than Trump's. You know, you might need to, you know, have some historical basis or something like that. So Mussolini in the pink shirt. And, you know, I know he's behaved in this way, and you know, it was easier to get forgiveness than permission. So me walking in there, I was the host of the show. I think actually, you know, was, you know, certainly booked to be, you know, the one of the main guys on the show, but I showed up, you know, with a cameraman, and I was, you know, already half lit. There was a problem too, because the alcohol and drugs that I was using, it started to become more and more prevalent within my, you know, showing up. So, you know, if you're an asshole and you don't smell like alcohol, they might have a problem with you. If you're an asshole and you do smell like alcohol, then they'll just go like, get the hell out of here, right? So I think that's kind of what happened at Yuck Yucks. And then by that point, I was just on a tear. So when I showed up to the Kingston, I was just, you know, like, you know, drinking hard and just saying, you know, whatever I wanted. And, you know, it's a fairly blurry time for me, so I can't tell you exactly what I said, but I do remember the pink shirt and the Mussolini thing. I think I was mocking the Kingston because there was no audience there. There's a shot of me going, hey, look at my crowd.
Yes, like nobody there. Yes, you do.
Right. And so,
Wasn't there the thing, though, with Marla's eyes, I guess, like a couple weeks before? Didn't you try to perform Marla's eyes? And then that kind of, I thought there was a story around that with like a heckler who was kind of going at you. We left that out, but I can't remember. I thought there was a thing that like a few weeks before at the Kingston, you were getting ready to perform Marla's Eyes and Marla was there. Remember that song on the piano you had? And then it kind of, someone, I think, had a go at you that night, and then you you know, that was kind of the end of it.
Could be, Roy, but you have to remember a couple of things. One is when you were filming me during that time, I was spiraling into hitting bottom from alcohol and drug addiction. Also, I lied. You know, so whatever I said, the reason because I got kicked out, alcoholics are great at blaming other people for things that have happened to them, right? These guys believe they were all jealous of how awesome I was, and they wish they had said that first, or whatever it was, but, you know, so, you know, it's kind of hard to account for what actually happened back then. You're the one with the footage, you know?
Well, that's true. I don't know the answer.
Back to you, Roy. I'm going to try to bounce between the two as best I can. How was guerrilla shooting? Because I think you do a lot of it in this film. Did you have to hide your camera a lot and just sort of bring a little one, or did they let you bring in your camera a lot?
No, I just did what I normally do. It was pretty easy to take the camera around. At the time, I had a Sony V1U, so it was right when digital, it was before DSLRs, so this is back in 2009. It's much easier to be kind of sneaky nowadays, but back then I had my camera, so it actually helped because I looked a little bit more professional. So people and when Graham had a nice camera too at that time, so people were actually kind of excited, you know, that, and that's why I say it worked to our advantage, and then sometimes it never really hurt us. You just kind of had to finagle through it. Because Richard really knew where all the spots were, and he knew everyone, right? So it wasn't like we didn't know where we were going and who we were going to encounter. So when we would go places and we had a camera crew, like I said, like Richard at the time, it kind of helped them because people were like, oh, damn, like, why are they doing a documentary on Richard? Like, he must be something big time, and it kind of helped to our advantage. And the club owners were pretty chill, except for, like I said, at Yuck Yucks that night when I first tried to go film the beginning of the film, that club owner at the time was absolutely pissed that I showed up with a camera, and I thought I got Richard in trouble. So I just was like, oh, sorry, man. I sat down and put my camera down and just sat on the bench and waited for Richard to show up. And yeah, that's when they just like went at it. And I didn't film that. I really wish I did, but I was like, I thought I was in trouble and going to like hurt Richard at this venue because I'm like filming. Right. So I was like, oh shit, sorry. And I sat down and then they just went at it. And then we went outside and filmed something. But most of the time it was pretty relaxed. I mean, I just, everywhere I went, I had my camera and I just recorded and I let it roll as much as I could, and if people told me to stop, I would stop, and if people told me to get out, I would then get out, but most of the time everyone was pretty open to it and cool with it, except for like when he obviously, that heckler we got, she was crying and stuff like that, we were pretending like we weren't recording when we were. So we just kind of held the camera by our side like it was off and just, you know, did our best to film her and then blurred her face out because I didn't have her released.
Okay, that's cool. Okay, I was going to get to hecklers later, but we can start out. Richard, when somebody heckles you in the audience, how do you deal with them? I mean, you are very good at what you do. Do you automatically have one response, or your first things make fun of their face, their looks, or you don't care, you just go?
Well, you know, there's an intuitive thing that comes from heckling. There's also probabilities. The chances that people that are heckling you have been drinking. There's chances that the people that are heckling you are in need of attention, and there's also a chance that the people that are heckling you are not the sharpest knives in the drawer. And so you can play to your advantage. You know, of course, every comedian has a clip of, you know, a load of jokes that they can draw from these stock heckling lines that can sort of put the heckler back on their heels. You know, whether it be, you know, the classic, I thought I told you to wait in the car, all the way through to suggestions that they are male prostitutes, or what, you know, I can rattle off all those jokes. I'd give you my autograph, but who'd read it to you? Things like that. However, the key ones are the intuitiveness that happens. I remember I was doing a show in a place called Christina Lake in the southern border of BC, and I was doing my show, and two guys walked in the middle of the show, and they were loud, and they were sort of being entitled and full of themselves, and I said, just sell your drugs and get out of here. And the place went crazy because I had pinpointed the two drug dealers in town. And so, you know, there's an intuitive sense that you have when somebody's behaving a certain way, or, you know, like some people would come up and say, you know that woman you called a bitch? She's the town's biggest bitch. And I'm going, no kidding, right? You know, you can just sense that, and so, you know, I've gotten myself in trouble by being too on the nose with this stuff. But yeah, I am good at that. But it, you know, there's also this sort of people that knew me and sort of cared about me and perhaps were concerned about me would make comments about how they could see the, like the devil in my eyes as I would start to, you know, I'd found a live one, right? I remember, and we do hone in on that. And I saw Bill Burr do a show a year or so ago before, you know, the pandemic and all that. And some woman had heckled him, and the staff, it was a big, you know, theater show. So the door staff removed her before Bill could have his way with her, so to speak, right? And he kept looking at her, where'd you go, right? And they said, you know, finally got the impression that she had been removed. He goes, oh, there's an itch I won't be able to scratch. And that's really kind of what that feels like. You feel like, you know, he got better. Of course, you know, I've gotten in trouble. I remember I was doing a show, and there was a woman that was yammering at me, and I put the mic stand by my crotch and said, you know, here, put this in your mouth. Do I remind you of your dad now? And she was the daughter of the mayor of that town, and the mayor and his wife were there. And so that went badly for me. I'm trying not to, you know, sometimes you come up with a way of dealing with people that's brutal, and you try not to ever do that again because you pay that price, but there's always that little, you know, tap on the shoulder going, well, you know, you can use the, you know, you can use the howitzer if you want. I try not to. Now that I'm sober in my performances, there's very little heckling. I just don't have that kind of energy that people want to attack me, and I feel no need to attack them back. But back in the day, you know, I was ripping them new ones from one end of the country to the other, I have to admit.
Okay, back to Roy. Roy, how is filming Richard's drug use? Because that's a big part of your film. I mean, a big part of Richard's life, too, is this drug use. And I did noticing, it took me a few minutes, I'm like, we're doing this again. And we're in a different room. And I noticed your bongs. I started counting them, that they were different. I'm like, this guy is doing a lot of drugs. So how does that feel as a friend, filming a friend going, hey, he shouldn't be doing this as much? But you're also a filmmaker, so you can't really intervene.
Yeah, Roy,
why?
Good question. Well, I think it says a lot about where I was at the time, right, in my life. So, you know, the blind leading the blind, I guess. Well, when I first met Richard, it was in a professional manner. So it's not, like I said, like when we actually sat down and talked and then it evolved into something, a friendship really didn't form there. Right. It wasn't really until after all that, and Richard has walked through what he's walked through, that behind the scenes, that's when I believe the relationship with Richard formed. At that time, I was just doing what a documentarian would do, which is just get out of the way and follow the footage. It's not my job to step in the middle and help or to touch it, because then it would no longer be a documentary. It would be a mockumentary. So from my perspective, I was following the very basic number one rule of a documentarian filmmaker, which is follow the footage. Don't get in the way, stay out of the way. So that's what I did. And, I believe it was, worked out the way it was supposed to work out. I believe that it worked out beautifully because, you know, if you look at addiction and if you've ever dealt with anyone with addiction, they always say, like, the worst thing you can do if you're not the addict and dealing with an addict is not to enable them, right? So, you know, you look at people in Al-Anon and the big question is, like, who's sicker, the person who's the alcoholic or the person that's choosing to continue to live with the alcoholic, right? And knowing they're an alcoholic. So what they teach you is to not enable addicts, right? So if you're struggling with someone in your family that is an addict, the worst thing you can do is give them money, because they can go off and just kill themselves with that money, right? So for me, just staying out of the way and never ever giving Richard anything, right? Like didn't even help him move when that stuff. It's like, of course it's heartbreaking to watch and it's hard and it's not something that I'm necessarily proud of, right? But am I always have this feeling of humility that runs over me and gratitude when I get asked this question, because it could have turned out really badly and Richard could have died and then I would just be sitting here with a bunch of footage of a guy who's dead, and I don't want to release this documentary, and I could be sitting here going, you know, not talking to you and sitting in my life being like, yeah, I probably could have put down the camera and maybe tried to help this person. However, it's weird how it worked, because I believe that there was a higher presence there guiding both of us and letting us just to do our thing. And, you know, God had it the whole time. And I look at Richard and I think that by me not stepping in and ever paying his rent or giving him food, or the most I ever did was buy him a pack of smokes when he was at the homeless shelter and then took him and a couple other homeless people out for pizza that day. You know, that was the most I gave. And I was the closest to him at the time. So if anything, it just really helped drive this rock bottom even harder, because if I would have been paying for things or helping, maybe Richard would have never have gotten it. You know, it may have been taking him longer, and the longer it takes, the more chances are there of death. So I don't know. I definitely am not claiming I'm not trying to claim Richard's sobriety by any means, but yeah, definitely it's difficult filming something like that. It's not easy. It's definitely a gut check and a moral check. And I just kept coming back to the idea of, you know, love lets go, and you got to be able to just trust the process and get out of the way and let love do what love does. And that's what happened here. And that's why I believe that this is like a miracle that this happened, because to this day, even when I finished the edit, like it was like, I would talk with Richard and it's like, look, if the movie's not good and it's not supposed to be out, then I'm not going to put it out. You know, if the message in this movie isn't going to inspire other addicts or help someone, then this project's supposed to not to be out. And I've always had that attitude. If it's not supposed to be out there, it's not supposed to be out there. We're constantly practicing letting it go. And that's just been the philosophy of this whole film. And Richard's just been Richard, and I've just been Roy documenting it this whole time. So yeah, I don't recommend doing that as your first movie, any filmmakers out there. However, I sure am grateful that it turned out this way. And And like I said, thank God that it did turn out this way. And to me, it opened up my faith for sure that this all turned out the way it turned out, because I know of myself, like, you know, like I said, at that time, it was just fun and games for me too, right? And so that's why I say, like, you know, it says a lot about me at that time too, right? So, yeah, it is what it is. I hope I answered your question.
You did. Okay, Richard, there's a mural in the film of you. You're on a mural on a wall.
Yes.
At the time of the film, you couldn't name the other people besides you. Can you now?
Oh, yes. Well, that mural, hang on, honey, I don't know if you should put the kettle on. Well, it was all the local comedians that performed at Loud Fun. So, Gerald Lennox, Janice Sungaro, Billy Mitchell, Erwin Barker, you know, were some of the ones that were there. I was right at the top, and I signed my name because everyone was going to sign theirs, but I'm the only one that did, so it kind of looks like it was like, hey, what about me? but, you know, sometimes I just do what I'm told, and then it ends up making me look like a bit of an ass. But it is, the mural is no longer there, but it stayed there for a long, long time, and people would drive by and they go like, you painted on a wall in New Westminster, or my daughter would see it and go, you know, people would stop and get photos, and they would send me pictures of it like I didn't know about it. Right? You know, people do that. You know, I was once on the cover of a magazine, and someone decided to take all of those magazines from the store that they were sitting and give them to me. I said, I don't need them. The point, you know, like, what? Leave them there. That's so other people can see it. I have a copy of it, you know. Anyway,
okay.
People are weird that way.
I have a couple more questions just for you, Richard, just so you know. As a comedian, do you like doing a dirty show or a clean show mostly?
Oh, I prefer the dirty shows, just because, you know, whether or not you're actually being any more dirty, you just don't feel that kind of, you know, sort of bit in your mouth restraining you. The other thing, strangely, you know, is that when you do a clean show, which are generally corporate shows, the audience tend to be douchebags, and you know they're not clean at all. So there you are up there, and you know that you're doing this show based on the contract that you get, and whatever report or, you know, summary of the show would happen, you know, a week from then. But meanwhile, the people at the show are plastered out of their minds and saying, you know, the most scurrilous things, and you don't have the you know, your full sort of arsenal to deal with them, right? The strange thing about a corporate show is that everybody there knows each other, and you're the only stranger. In a normal show, they don't know each other, and you're what they have in common. What they have in common at a corporate show is some crap job that they sold their soul to, and I'm just some guy coming in to be just another. They treat you like the help. You know, corporate season, Christmas season is a nightmare for comedians. We get paid well, but we don't get paid as much as we deserve because of what the way they treat us, which is like that we are the new mail boy, and the mail boy, the actual mail boy, has the perfect right to, you know, say stuff to you, and you don't have the right to say anything back. So, you know, it's so dirty shows, yeah. And, you know, just normal shows, but it doesn't take much to clean things up, you know. But on the other hand, Yeah, I don't think any comedian prefers the clean show, except for those guys that always do clean and they all pride themselves at being clean. And some of them are serving rather long prison sentences. So we can just look at clean comedians and wonder what's going on inside there, right? And what's in my drink? I'm feeling a little watery.
Back to Roy. How long did you film this for, or did I miss it in the film? Did you tell me at one point how long? It looked like 10 years, I would guess.
Yeah, 7 years.
7 years, okay. Now, how much footage did you have? Like, hours you must have had.
Yeah. Hundreds of hours, yeah. Yeah, lots. There was, let's see, we did it over 7 years, and then we had a few years of post-production. So it, I think 10 years total it took to make. And then I don't know the exact number of hours of footage.
No, that's fine. Hundreds of hours works.
Yeah, hundreds of hours. It's a lot to go through. And that was just my footage, and then I had archive footage that Richard – I got off of Richard before he got kicked out of his apartment, and then I pulled a lot of stuff off YouTube as well.
So, Richard, a part of the film that's right near the end, I mean, obviously you know now, which is never responded to, your daughter gets a new tattoo and shows Roy the sleeve.
Yes.
What was your reaction to that? Because we never get that in the film.
Well, yeah, because I didn't see it until I saw it in film. Right?
Really?
And,
we got it on camera, actually. We filmed him, but we have it in a behind the scenes for the DVD of when Richard's watching it in Whistler, and he sees it for the first time. He goes, "Whoa!" It was great. Anyway, sorry, Richard, to cut you off, but go ahead.
So, how was the reaction? I guess I have to wait for the DVD release to see it.
Well, you know, yeah, I was surprised because it was like a full sleeve, and now it's completed, right? And I, I just took a picture. I wonder if I can do this, share on my screen. The picture I took of Brianna today, and Chelsea, one of Roy's producers, commented on Instagram that her arm looks great because it's, you know, all filled in, the whole story of the koi fish and all that. Then after the documentary screening, then I went and we had lunch, and I said, okay, let's see it. she rolls up her sleeve, and I just go like, wow, because it is a full sleeve. And, it's kind of funny because I think what happened in the documentary, she says, he says, can I see it? She goes, well, will he see it? No, not for a long time. So, I was surprised, that something had, because I'd seen her, a lot of times since then, but she had managed to be wearing long sleeves the whole time and didn't really want to share that at that point. So, but I've seen it now. It's a beautiful tattoo, and she's, it's a Japanese art, and it's quite an extraordinary piece. But at the time, every father's going, you did what?
I was thinking the same thing.
I did this tattoo. We share. She has one on her. We shared the identical tattoo on our thighs, and I thought that was enough. Didn't know that her whole arm would be, going on the other side. But tattoo people, it tends to be addictive, and, so they like to get more of them. I'm pretty happy with the one I got, and I don't really think I'm going to get any more because I don't want to have two tattoos but only want to show you one of them, right? I got lucky with this one. It's a beautiful tattoo, and I'll just stick to that.
Okay, we're going to get to the end here. I'm going to ask you your favorite three questions, and
all right,
whatever answer you want to give is perfect. Your favorite film, because it's your first time being on the show.
My favorite movie is Runaway Train with John Voight and Eric Roberts and Rebecca De Mornay. I understand it's a brilliant character study. So of all the movies I could watch, again, you know, I'll just give you that one. I know on Facebook they'd say, see your favorite movie and these idiots like list off 30 movies and you go, yeah, you missed the point. So Runaway Train.
Roy, same question.
Rocky 2.
Wow.
Because he wins at the end. Well, obviously, I love Rocky 1. It's an Oscar-winning movie. It's amazing. But I've loved the Rocky series ever since I was a boy, and I always loved Rocky 2 because he wins the title on it. So I was like, yeah, I love Rocky 2.
Since both of you have
I got lots of movies, but I'll give you Rocky 2.
Fair enough. Your favorite comedian right now?
I have to go with Bill Burr. I've been listening to his podcast. He's a hockey fan. I feel like he's sort of a brother.
Well, he's from Boston, so he's allowed to be.
Ah,
yeah. My favorite comedian, Dave Chappelle. I've been fortunate enough to be able to work with him. He's been by my studio, and we've been able to work on a show of his. And he's a wonderful guy in person. Like, he's so cool. Like, he's just a genuine guy. Like, what you see on stage is you kind of think, like, oh, is he like that in real life? Yes, he is. He's that really genuine human being who's been through a lot, and he cares about other people and he cares about himself. And I'll share a quick story with him. First time I ever met him, he came into my studio to work, and he, you know, I just give him his space. He's obviously a high profile individual, and I don't know how they're going to behave. So the best thing to do is just let them do their thing and not be a fanboy, you know? So I just sat in my office and did my work, and he was in the other room working with one of the editors. And then when he came out, he poked his head in my office and he was like, "Hey man." And I just like spin around in my chair and I'm like, "Hey, what's up?" And he goes, "Oh, I just wanted to say thanks for having me over." And I was like, "Yeah, anytime." And then he's like, yeah, real cool spot. And I was like, yeah. And then he like came in and sat down with me. And then like, I have like a bullet hole in my studio, like in the window for some reason. It's on Burbank Boulevard here in North Hollywood. So he's like, "Is that a bullet hole?" And then he's doing his whole Chappelle thing. And yeah, he just like hung out. And then like my staff came out and everyone hung out with him. And my whole thing was just like, I just let everyone know, no pictures. Don't ask for a photo. Don't ask for any of that. Just hang out with him and be cool. And and he was really, really a warm, loving guy who just came in and just embraced everyone. And obviously we were all excited to meet him. So it was really cool. But yeah, awesome dude. And he's just a great guy.
Okay.
I'm wasted with Dave Chappelle.
You both have traveled all over Canada for sure. And Richard, you probably done a lot of the States over the years.
Sure.
What's your favorite place to visit?
I think Newfoundland. You know, there's something about that place. I mean, everybody there is kind of a stand-up comedian. You know, it's just amazing, the stories, but they're not like, you know, sometimes you meet someone who thinks they're funny and therefore, you know, you can't be funny too, and they're kind of a stick in the mud when you do your show. In Newfoundland, not only are they funny, but they love comedy, and they just laugh and embrace you and just want to be your friend. I remember, I was there on a tour, and I was coming up to the end of it, and I was sitting in some bar, and someone said to me, "So when are you leaving?" I said, "I'm not." You know, I remember I went to one of my 12-step meetings there after I came back, and I was sober, and, you know, it's a traditional thing in a 12-step meeting for people from out of town to introduce themselves. You know, I'm Richard, I'm an alcoholic from Toronto, and so I was living in Toronto at the time. And about the third or fourth day in St. John's, I raised my hand and introduced myself, and somebody in the back said, "Oh, Richard, you're not a visitor anymore." So yeah, I really think that's an amazing place.
Roy, same question.
Yeah, you know, I actually haven't been to a whole lot of places in Canada, but I will say my favorite place to visit and where my dream is to build a cabin is back home where I'm from in Fort Francis, Ontario. I want to build a cabin on Ray Lake. So every summer, except for this one, I try and make a trip home and rent a cabin. And I stay on the lake for 2 weeks and I fish and just get to do outdoor stuff. So that's a dream of mine and that's where I love to go. That's where I want to be the rest of my life. It's just... I'd like to die on a lake.
Sorry to tell you, that's one of the best summers in Canada and Ontario ever.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's nothing like cottaging in Ontario. Nothing beats cottaging in Ontario.
Okay, Richard, this is up to you. This is your big shot. Where can they see the story of your life?
Where can they see it?
Yeah.
Well, on their laptop. you know. But that being said, this is my chance to promote myself, right?
Correct.
So besides Roy's documentary, which has got published all over the world, I am doing a fringe show, it's a theater show, and I am doing that in September the 15th to the 20th at Performance Force on Granville Island. And I... in July, I had a mild case of the COVID-19.
Uh-oh.
So, and you know, so the documentary, you know, that I also went through cancer. And so the show that I was going to do in the Vancouver Fringe dealt with my testicular cancer called One Nut Only. But then I got the virus, and there's all, and it's not like, this surviving cancer 10 years ago seems to be a little bit been there, done that. So I thought, you know, I'd take the opportunity to change things up. I didn't know how I was going to do it until I ran into a colleague of mine, a guy named Dino Archie. And he said to me, he was regaling one of his friends with all the crap that I'd gone through with the cancer and addiction and COVID, and he goes, you should do a show called Hard to Kill. I like that. He goes, yeah, it's hard to kill. You know, it's kind of sexy. It's kind of, you know, like an action figure and all that kind of stuff. And so what I'm doing in a couple of weeks is that I'm doing a show that deals with addiction, cancer, and COVID, and being a mall Santa, having a bipolar girlfriend, just being a stand-up comedian, and it'll be like an hour-long Q&A where I'll do some poems, I'll do some songs, I'll tell some stories and do some jokes. But the order of the show and the nature of it, the show will be fluid. I've decided eventually that, you know, I'm Richard Lent, and, you know, I'm actually kind of enjoying that. I didn't always enjoy being Richard Lent. I didn't always refer to myself in the third person either, but but the point is that I'm kind of having fun, and I don't really worry about it too much. You know, when they asked me on the publicity for the Fringe Festival, you know, what sort of hook that I would have for them to promote the show, I said, I had COVID-19. Oh, you want some more? I'm Richard Lent, you know. So what's the show? Richard Lent had COVID-19. And if the publicity person, the media person you're talking to doesn't understand what that means, don't bother talking to them because they're not going to be any use to us anyway. So...
Right.
Yeah, hard to kill. Because I am. I'm hard to kill, man. Look at me. The great thing about the documentary and why Roy likes Rocky 2 instead of Rocky 1 is because synchronistically, I didn't die. You know, I won. I won sobriety. And the nature of this documentary shows that, you know, that you can survive. You can make it. You can live. right? There's been too many documentaries that ended prematurely and rather grimly. This one doesn't. This one is evidence that recovery is possible because I'm sitting here talking to you. So,
yep.
I apologize. Roy, tell me where I can find your films before I have to edit more than I want to.
Yeah, you can go see it at neverbedone.com or just Google Never Be Done, the Richard Glenn Lett story, and it'll pop up on a bunch of platforms where you can rent it. Right now it's on sale for 99 cents, so there you go.
When's the DVD out?
The DVD will probably be around Christmas time, I want to say. I don't know specifically, but near the end of the year. For right now, just get it anywhere.
Will there be extras in it?
Yes, there's a BTS at the world premiere at Whistler.
Nice.
Thank you for your time, gentlemen. Have a great evening.
Thank you,
Thank you.
Yeah.
See you later. See you, Roy.
Bye.
Bye.